Chapter 11. The tigers had gone, and servants were openly carrying things away.
"Good morning, ma'am,"
said Jack, springing up. Diana curtsied.
"I have brought you a letter from Stephen Maturin."
"Oh, how is he?"
she cried.
"Very low, a great deal of fever. The ball is badly lodged, and in this climate a wound... But you know all about wounds in this climate."
Her eyes filled with tears. She had expected hardness, but not this cold anger. He was taller than she had remembered him, altogether bigger and more formidable. His face had changed, the boy quite gone, vanished beyond recall. A hard, commanding eye. The only thing she recognized, apart from his uniform, was his yellow hair, tied in a queue. And even his uniform had changed. He was a post-captain now.
"You will excuse me, Aubrey,"
she said, and opened the note. Three straggling, uneven lines. "Diana, you must come back to Europe. The Lushington sails on the 14th. Allow me to deal with any material difficulties. Rely upon me at all times. I say at all times. Stephen." She read it slowly, and again, peering through the mist of tears. Jack stood, his back turned, looking out of the window with his hands behind his back. Beneath the anger and the distaste for being there, his mind was filled with questions, doubts, a hurry of feelings that he could not easily identify. Righteousness, except where faulty seamanship was concerned, or an offence against naval discipline, was unfamiliar to him. Was he a contemptible scrub to harbour this enmity against the woman he had pursued? The severity that filled him from head to toe, was it an odious hypocrisy, fit to damn him in a decent mind? He had gone near to wrecking his career in his pursuit of her. She had preferred Canning. Was this holier-than-thou indignation mere pitiful resentment? No, it was not. She had hurt Stephen terribly, and Canning, that fine man, was dead. She was no good. No good at all. Yet that meeting under the trees could have taken place over the most virtuous of women, the world being what it was. Virtue. He turned it over, vaguely watching a horseman winding through the trees. He had attacked her virtue as hard as ever he could. So where did he stand? The common cant, "It is different for men," was no comfort. The horseman came in sight again, and his horse into full view. Perhaps the most beautiful animal he had ever seen. A chestnut mare, perfectly proportioned, light, powerful. She shied at a snake on the drive and reared, a lovely movement, and her rider sat easy, kindly patting her neck. Virtue. The one he esteemed above all was courage, and surely it included all the rest. He looked at her ghost-like image in the windowpane. She possessed it. Never a doubt of that. She was standing there perfectly straight, so slim and frail he could break her with one hand. A tenderness and admiration he had thought quite dead moved in him. "Mr. Johnston," said a servant.
"I am not at home."
The horseman rode away.
"Aubrey, will you give me a passage home in your ship?"
"No, ma'am. The regulations do not admit of it. In any case, she is unfit for a lady, and I have another month and more of refitting."
"Stephen has asked me to marry him. I could act as a nurse."
"I regret extremely my orders will not allow it. But the Lushington sails within the week, and if I can be of any assistance, I should be most happy."
"I always knew you were a weak man, Aubrey," she said, with a look of contempt, "but I did not know you were a scrub. You are much the same as every man I have ever known, except for Maturin. False, weak, and a coward in the end."
He made his bow, and walked out of the room with an appearance of composure. In the drive he passed a cook, pushing a handcart loaded with brass pots and saucepans.
"Am I indeed a scrub?" he asked,
and the question tormented him all the way to Howrah, where the frigate lay. The moment he saw her tall mainmast high above the mass of shipping, he walked even faster, ran up the gangway, passed through the waiting officers and shipwrights, and went below.
"Killick," he said, "find out if Mr. Mallister is busy with the doctor. If he is not, I wish to see him."
Stephen was in the great cabin, the airiest, lightest place in the ship. There seemed to be a good deal of activity in there. Mallister came out, with a drawing in his hand, followed by the boatswain, the carpenter, and several of their mates. He looked anxious and upset.
"How is he?"
asked Jack.
"The fever is far too high, sir," said Mallister, "but I hope it will come down when we have extracted the ball. We are almost ready now, but it is very badly placed."
"Should he not be taken to the hospital? Their surgeons could give you a hand. We can have a litter ready in a moment."
I did suggest it, of course, as soon as we found the bullet right under the pericardium. Flattened and deflected, you understand. But he has no opinion of the military surgeons, nor of the hospital. They sent to offer their assistance not half an hour since, and I confess I should welcome it. The pericardium, hoot, toot. But he insists on performing the operation himself, and I dare not cross him. You will excuse me now, sir. The armourer is waiting to make this extractor he has designed.
May I see him?
Yes, but pray do not disturb him or agitate his mind.
Stephen was lying on a series of chests, propped up with his back against a thrum mat, the whole covered with sailcloth. Over against him, showing his naked chest in the fullest light, a large mirror slung by a system of blocks and lines. Beside him, within reach, a table covered with lint, tow, and surgical instruments, crowbills, retractors, a toothed demi-lune. He looked at Jack and said,
"Did you see her?"
"Yes."
"I am deeply obliged to you for going. How was she?"
"Bearing up. She has all the spirit in the world. Stephen, how do you feel?"
"What was she wearing?"
"Wearing? Oh, a sort of dress of some sort, I suppose. I did not attend."
"Not black?"
"No, I should have noticed that. Stephen, you look damnably feverish. Shall I have the skylight unshipped for air?"
Stephen shook his head.
"There is some little fever, of course, but not enough to cloud my mind to any degree. That may come later. I wish Bates would hurry with my davier."
"Will you let me bring the Fort William man just to stand by? He could be here in 5 minutes."
"No, sir. I do this with my own hand."
He looked at it critically and said, more or less to himself, "If it could undertake the one task, it must undertake the other. That is but justice." Mallister came back, holding a long-nosed instrument with little jaws straight from the armourer's forge. Stephen took it, compared its curve with his drawing, snapped its levered beak, and said,
"Cleverly made. Neat. Charming. Mallister, let us begin. Pray call for Choles, if he is sober."
"Is there anything I can do?" asked Jack. "I should very much like to help. May I hold a basin, or pass the tow?"
"You may take Choles's place, if you wish, and hold my belly, pressing firmly, thus, when I give the word. But have you a head and a stomach for this kind of thing? Does blood upset you? Choles was a butcher, you know."
"Bless you, Stephen. I have seen blood and wounds since I was a little boy."
Blood he had seen, to be sure, but not blood, not this cold, deliberate ooze in the slow track of the searching knife and probe. Nor had he heard anything like the grind of the demi-lune on living bone, a few inches from his ear as he leant over the wound, his head bent low not to obscure Stephen's view in the mirror.
"You will have to raise the rib, Mallister," said Stephen. "Take a good grip with the square retractor. Up. Harder. Harder. Snip the cartilage."
The metallic clash of instruments, directions, perpetual quick swabbing, an impression of brutal force beyond anything he had conceived. It went on and on and on.
"Now, Jack, a steady downward pressure, good. Keep it so. Give me the davier. Swab, Mallister. Press, Jack. Press."
Deep in the throbbing cavity, Jack caught a glimpse of a leaden gleam. It clouded, and there, half-focused, was the long-nosed instrument searching deeper and deeper. He closed his eyes. Stephen drew his breath and held it, arching his back. In the silence, Jack could hear the ticking of Mallister's watch close to his ear. There was a grunt, and Stephen said,
"Here she is. Much flattened. Mallister, is the bullet whole?" "Whole, sir, by God. Quite whole. Not a morsel left to brawly feck it." "Easy away, Jack. Handsomely with the retractor, Mallister. A couple of pledgets, and you may begin to sew. Stay, look to the captain, while I swab. Hartshorn, put his head down."
Mallister heaved him bodily into a chair. Jack felt his head pressed down between his knees and the pungent hartshorn searching his brain. He looked up and saw Stephen. His face was now perfectly grey, glistening with sweat. It was barely human, but somewhere about it there was a look of surly triumph. Jack's eye moved down to Stephen's chest, ploughed open from side to side, deep, deep, and white bone bare. Then Mallister's back hid the wound as he set to work, a competent back, expressing ease and a share in the triumph. Competent activity, short technical remarks, and there was Stephen, his chest swatched in a white bandage, sponged, relaxed, leaning back with his eyes half closed.
"You took the time, Malister?" he asked.
23 minutes, just."
"Slow."
His voice trailed away, reviving after a moment to say,
"Jack, you will be late for your dinner."
Jack began to protest that he should stay, but Malister put his finger to his lips and led him on tiptoe to the door. More of the ship's company than was right were hanging about outside it. A discipline seemed to have been forgotten.
"The ball is out," he said. "Pullings, let there be no noise abaft the mainmast, no noise at all,"
and walked into his sleeping cabin.
"You look wholly pale yourself, sir," said Bondon. "Will you take a dram?"
"You will have to change your coat, your honour," said Killick, "and your breeches too." "Christ, Bondon," said Jack, "he opened himself slowly, with his own hands, right to the heart. I saw it, beating there."
"Ah, sir, there's surgery for you," said Bondon, passing the glass. "That would not surprise any old Sophie, however, such a learned article. You remember the gunner, sir? Never let it put you off your dinner. He will be as right as a trivet. Never you fret, sir."
The dinner was a splendid affair, eaten off a blaze of gold, and without reflecting, he swallowed a pound or two of some animal aswim in a fiery sauce. His neighbours were affable, but after they had exhausted the common topics, they gave him up as a heavy fellow, and he made his way mutely through the succeeding courses, each with its own wine. In the comparative silence he heard the conversation of the two civilians opposite, the one a deaf and aged judge with green spectacles and a braying voice, the other a portly member of council. Towards the end of dinner they were both flushed and far from steady. Their subject was Canning, his unpopularity, his bold and independent activity.
"From all I hear," said the judge, "you gentlemen will be inclined to present the survivor with a pair of gold inlaid pistols, if not a service of plate."
"I do not speak for myself," said the member of council, "since Madras is the scene of my labours, but I believe there are some here who will shed no tears in their mourning coaches."
"And what about the woman? Is it true they mean to expel her as an undesirable person? I should prefer to see a good old-fashioned flogging at the cart's tail. It is many years since I've had that pleasure, sir. Should you not itch to hold the whip? For undesirable person is only to be construed in the administrative sense in this case.
A buller's wife called to see how she was supporting her misfortune. She was not admitted, however.
Prostrated, of course, quite prostrated, I'm sure. But tell me about the fire-eating Irish sawbones. Was the woman his—"
An aide-de-camp came up behind them and whispered between their heads. The judge cried,
"What? Eh? Oh, I was not aware."
He brought his spectacles some way down his nose and peered at Jack, who said,
"You are speaking of my friend, Dr. Maturin, sir. I trust the woman to whom you have referred is in no way connected with the lady who honours Maturin and me with her acquaintance?"
"No, no," they assured him. They meant not the least offence to the gentleman, would be happy to withdraw any facetious expression, would never dream of speaking of a lady known to Captain Aubrey with disrespect. They hoped he would drink a glass of wine with them. "By all means," said he. And presently the judge was led away. The next day, on the padded quarter-deck of the Surprise, Jack received Diana with less rigour than she had expected. He told her that Maturin was sleeping at the moment, but if she chose to sit below with Mr. Malister, she would learn all that could be learnt about his state, and if Stephen woke, Malister might let her in. He sent down all that the Surprise could offer in the way of refreshments, and when she went away at last, after a long, vain wait, he said,
"I hope you will have better luck another time. But indeed this sleep is the greatest blessing. It is the first he has had."
"Tomorrow I cannot get away. There is so much to be done. On Thursday, if I may?"
"Certainly. And if any of my officers can be of use, we shall be most happy. Pullings and Babington, you know. Or Bondon for an escort. These docks are hardly the place for a lady."
"How kind. I should be glad of Mr. Babington's protection."
"Lord Braithwaite," said Friday's Babington, double-shaved, shining in his gold-laced hat, "how I love that Mrs. Villiers!"
Braithwaite sighed and shook his head.
"She makes the rest look like brutes from Portsmouth Point."
"I shall never look at another woman again, I'm sure. Here she comes. I see her carriage beyond the dhow."
He ran to hand her up the gangway into the quarter-deck.
"Good day to you, ma'am," said Jack. "He is considerably better, and I am happy to say he has ate an egg. but there is still a great deal of fever, and I beg you will not upset or cross him in any way. Malister says it is most important not to cross him in any way."
"Dear Maturin," she said, "how glad I am to see you sitting up. Here are some mangosteens. They are the very thing for a fever. But are you sure you are well enough to see visitors? They frighten me so, Aubrey, Pullings, Mr. Malister, and now even Bondon, telling me not to tire you or vex you, that I think I should go almost at once."
"I am as strong as an ox, my dear," said he, "and infinitely recovered by the sight of you.
At all events, I shall try not to upset you or cross you in any way. First, let me thank you for your dear note. It was a great comfort, and I am following your directions."
He smiled and said in a low voice,
"How happy you make me. But, Diana, there is the sordid aspect. Common requirements. Bread and butter.
In this envelope. Stephen, dear, you are the best of creatures, but I have bread and butter, and jam, too, for the moment. I sold a thumping great emerald the Nizam gave me, and I have booked the only decent cabin in the Lushington. I shall leave everything else behind. Just abandon it where it lies. The underbred frumps of Calcutta may call me names, but they shall not say I am interested."
"No, no indeed," said Stephen. "The Lushington. Roomy, comfortable, twice our size. The best sherry I have ever drunk. Yet I wish, you know, I wish you could have come home in the surprise. It would have meant waiting another month or so, but you did not think to ask Jack?"
"No, my dear," she said tenderly, "I did not. How stupid of me. But then there are the maids, you know, and I should hate you to see me seasick, green, squalid and selfish. It will make little odds in the long run, however. I dare say you will catch us up. We shall see one another at Madeira, or at all events in London. It will not be long. How parched you look. Let me give you something to drink. Is this barley water?"
They talked quietly. Barley water, mangosteens, eggs, the tigers of the Sundarbans. Or rather, she talked, and he lay there looking grave, transparent, but deeply happy, uttering a word or two. She said,
"Aubrey will certainly take great care of you. Will he make as good a husband as he does a friend, I wonder? I doubt it. He knows nothing whatsoever about women. Stephen, you are growing very tired. I shall go now. The Lushington sails at some impossible hour of the morning, at high tide. Thank you for my ring. Goodbye, my dear."
She kissed him, and her tears dropped on his face. The fetid ooze of the Hooghly gave way to the clearer sea of the Bay of Bengal, to the right dark blue of the Indian Ocean. The Surprise, homeward bound at last, spread her wings to the monsoon and raced away southwestwards in the track of the Lushington, now 2,000 miles ahead. She carried a sodden, disgruntled, flabby crew, a steel box filled with rubies, sapphires and pearls in chamois bags, a raving surgeon, and an anxious commander. He sat the night watches through by Stephen's cot ever since the fever had reached its present shocking height. Malister would have spelled him, or any one of the gunroom, but delirium had unlocked Stephen's secret mind, and although much of what he said was in French or Catalan, or meaningless except in the context of his private nightmare, much was direct, clear and specific. A less secret man might not have been so communicative. It poured out of Stephen's unconscious mouth in a torrent. Quite apart from official secrets, there were things Jack did not want any other man to hear. He was ashamed to hear them himself, for a man as proud as Stephen, and Lucifer could not hold a candle to him, it would be death to know that even the closest friend had heard his naked statements of desire and all his weaknesses laid as bare as Judgment Day. Discourses on adultery and fornication, imagined conversations with Richard Canning on the nature of the marriage bond, sudden apostrophes.
"Jack Aubrey, you too will pierce yourself with your own weapon, I fear. A bottle of wine inside you, and you will go to bed to the next wench that shows a gleam, quit with regretting it all your days. You do not know chastity."
Embarrassing words.
"Jew is an unearned distinction. Bastard is another. They should be brothers. Both at least are difficult friends, if not impossible, since both are sensitive to pricks unknown to the general."
So there Jack sat, sponging him from time to time, and the watches changed, and the ship ran on and on, and he thanked God he had officers he could trust to see to her routine. He sat sponging him, fanning him, and listening against his will, distressed, anxious, wounded at times, bored. He was no great hand at sitting mute and still, hour after hour, and the stress of hearing painful words was wearing. The stimulus lost its point in time, and a jaded weariness supervened, a longing for Stephen to be quiet. But Stephen, so taciturn in life, was loquacious in delirium, and his subject was the human state as a whole. He also had an inexhaustible memory. Jack heard whole chapters of Molina, and the greater part of the Nicomachean Ethics. Embarrassment and shame at his unfair advantage were bad enough, but even worse was the confusion of all his views. He had looked upon Stephen as the type of philosopher, strong, hardly touched by common feelings, sure of himself, and rightly so. He had respected no landsman more. This Stephen, so passionate, so wholly subjugated by Diana, and so filled with doubt of every kind, left him aghast. He would not have been more at a loss if he had found the surprise deprived of her anchors, ballast, and compass.
"Arma, virumque cano," began the harsh voice in the darkness, as some recollection of Diana's mad cousin set Stephen's memory in motion again.
"Well, thank God we are in Latin again," said Jack. "Long may it last."
Long indeed. It lasted until the equatorial channel itself, when the morning watch heard the ominous words,
"Est illi solvantur frigore membra. Etaque cum gemitu fugit indignata sub umbras."
Followed by an indignant cry for tea. For,
"Green tea there! Is there no one in this vile ship that knows how to look after a calenture? They've been calling and calling."
Green tea, or a change in the wind. It was now a little west or north. On the intercession of St. Stephen, lowered the fever from 1 hour to the next, and Malister kept it down with bark. But it was succeeded by a period of querulous peevishness that Jack found as trying as the Aeneid, and even he, with his experience of the seaman's long-suffering kindliness to a shipmate, wondered to see how they bore it. The surly, spoilt, consequential Killick called,
"That infamous double-poxed baboon!" and yet running with all his might to bring a spoon.
Bondon submitting patiently to assault with a kidney dish, elderly, ferocious forecastleman soothing him as they gently carried his chair to favoured points on deck, only to be cursed for every breeze and every choice. Stephen was a wretched patient. Sometimes he looked to Malister as an omniscient being who would certainly produce the one true physic. Sometimes the ship resounded to the cry of "Charlatan!" and drugs would be seen hurtling through the scuttle. The chaplain suffered more than the rest. Most of the officers haunted other parts of the ship when the convalescent Maturin was on the quarter-deck, but Mr. White could not climb, and in any case his duty required him to visit the sick, even to play chess with them. Once, goaded by a fling about Erastianism, he concentrated all his powers and won. He had to bear not only the reproachful looks of the helmsman, the quartermaster at the con, and the whole gunroom, but a semi-official rebuke from his captain, who thought it
a poor, shabby thing to set back an invalid's recovery for the satisfaction of the moment,
and the strokes of his own conscience. Mr. White was in a hopeless position, for if he lost, Dr. Maturin was quite as likely to cry out that he did not attend, and fly into a passion. Stephen's iron constitution prevailed, however, and a week later, when the frigate lay off a remote, uninhabited island in the Indian Ocean, whose longitude was set down differently in every chart, he went ashore, and there, on a day to be marked with a white stone, a white boulder indeed, he made the most important discovery of his life. The boat pulled through a gap in the coral reef to a strand with mangroves on the left and a palm-capped headland to the right, a strand upon which Jack had set up his instruments, and where he and his officers were gazing at the pale moon, with Venus clear above her, like a band of noonday necromancers. Choles and Malister lifted him out and set him on the dry sand. He staggered a little, and they led him up the beach to the shade of an immense, unnamed ancient tree, whose roots formed a comfortable ferny seat, and whose branches offered 14 different kinds of orchids to the view. There they left him, with a book and a paper of cigars, while the surveying of the anchorage and the astronomical observations went forward, a work of some hours. The instruments stood on a carefully levelled patch of sand, and as the great moment approached, the tension could be felt even from the tree. A deadly hush fell over the group, broken only by Jack's voice reading off figures to his clerk.
2, 7, 4, he said, straightening his back at last. Mr. Starton, what do you find?
2, 7, 4, sir, exactly.
The most satisfactory observation I've ever made, said Jack.
He clapped the eyepiece to and cast an affectionate glance at Venus, sailing away up there, distinct in the perfect blue once one knew where to look.
"Now we can stow all this gear and go aboard."
He strolled up the beach.
"Such a charming observation, Stephen," he called out as he came near the tree. "I'm sorry to have kept you so long, but it was worth it. All our calculations tally, and the chronometers were out by 27 mile. We have laid down the island as exactly—"
"My God, what is that monstrous thing?"
"It is a tortoise, my dear. The great land tortoise of the world. A new genus. He is unknown to science, and in comparison of him, your giants of Rodriguez and Aldabra are inconsiderable reptiles. He must weigh a ton. I do not know that I have ever been so happy. I am in such spirits, Jack. How you will ever get him aboard, I cannot tell, but nothing is impossible to the Navy."
"Must we get him aboard?"
"Oh, no question about it. He is to immortalize your name. This is Testudo Aubrey, for all eternity. When the hero of the Nile is forgotten, Captain Aubrey will live on, in his tortoise. There's glory for you."
"Why, I am much obliged, Stephen, I am sure. I suppose we might parbuckle him down the beach. How did you come by him?"
"I wandered a little way inland, looking for specimens. That box is filled with them. Such wealth. Enough for half a dozen monographs. And there he was, in an open space, eating ficus religiosa. I plucked some high shoots he was straining for, and he followed me down here, eating them. He is the most confiding creature, wholly without distrust. God help him and his kind when other men find out this island. See his gleaming eye? He would like another leaf. It does me good to see him. This tortoise has quite recovered me," he cried, putting his arm round the enormous carapace.
The tortoise turned the scale, as Malister said, his wit heated by the tropical sun. Its presence had a more tonic effect than all the bark, steel, and bezoar in the frigate's medicine chest. Stephen sat with Testudo Aubrey by the hencoops day after day as the Surprise ran down her southing. He increased in weight. His temper grew mild, equable, benevolent. On her outward voyage, the Surprise had done well enough, when she was neither crippled nor headed by foul winds, and it might have been thought that zeal had done all it could. But now she was homeward bound. The words were magic to her people, many of whom had wives or sweethearts, even more so to her captain, who was, he hoped, to be married, and who was heading not only for a bride, but also for the real theatre of war, for the possibility of distinction, of a gazette to himself, and indeed of prizes too. Then again the company had done her proud. No royal dockyards niggling over a halfpenny worth of tar, and her sumptuous refit, her new sails, new copper, beautiful Manila cordage, had brought back much of her youth. It had not dealt with certain deep-seated structural defects, the result of age and the Marengo's handling of her, but for the moment all was well, and she raced southwards as though she had a galleon in chase. The ship's company was in the highest training now. Their action had had its great cementing effect, but long before that the hands had settled down to a solid understanding, and an order was hardly given before it was carried out. The wind stood fair until they were far below Capricorn. Day after day she logged her 200 miles, pure, urgent sailing, all hands getting the last ounce out of her. The beautiful way of naval life that half-pay officers in their dim lodgings remember as their natural existence. Outward bound, they had not seen a sail from the height of the Cape to the Laccadives. This time they sighted 5, and spoke 3, an English bark-rigged privateer, an American bound for the China Seas, and a storeship for Ceylon. Each gave them news of the Lushington, whose lead, according to the storeship, was now little more than 700 miles. The warm sea grew cooler, almost cold. Waistcoats appeared in the night watches, and the northern constellations were no longer to be seen. Then, in 50 fathom water, not far from the Otter Shoal, they were startled by the barking of penguins in the mist, and the next day they reached the perpetual westerlies and the true change of climate. Now it was pea jackets and fur caps as the Surprise beat up, tack upon tack, boring into the wind under storm canvas, or flanked away southwards in search of a kinder gale, or lay a try, fighting for every mile of westing against the barrier of violent air. The petrels and the albatrosses joined company. The midshipmen's berth, then the gunroom, and then the cabin itself was down to salt beef and ship's bread again. The lower deck had never left it, and still the wind held in the west, with such thick weather that there was no observation for days on end. The tortoise had been struck down into the hold long since. He slept on a padded sack through the long, long rounding of the cape. His master did much the same, eating, gaining strength, and sorting his respectable Bombay collections, and his scraps, alas, too hurried, from other lands. He had little to do. The inevitable sailors' diseases the men had brought with them from Calcutta had been dealt with by Malister before he was recovered, and since then the ship, awash with the pure juice of limes, had been remarkably healthy. Hope, eagerness, and merriment had their usual effect, and the surprise was not only a happy ship, but a merry one. He had dealt with the Coleoptera, and he was deep in the vascular cryptograms before the frigate turned her head north at last. 5 days of variable winds and light airs, warmer by far, in which the surprise sent up her topgallant masts for the first time in weeks, and then on a temperate, moonlit night, when Stephen was sitting by the taffrail with Mr. White, watching him draw the fascinating pattern of the rigging, black shadows on the ghostly deck, pools of darkness, a waft heeled the ship, upsetting the Indian ink, and the phosphorescent water streamed along her larboard side. The heel increased, the hissing bubbles rose to a continual song. "If this is not the blessed trade," said Pullings, "I'm a Dutchman." No Dutchman he. It was the true southeast trade, gentle but sure, hardly varying a point. The surprise set a noble spread of canvas and glided on for the tropic line. The days grew warmer and warmer. The hands recovered from their battle with the cape, and now there was singing on the forecastle, and the sound of the hornpipe called the surprise's delight. But there was no heaving to for any thought of a swim this bout, even when they were so far beyond Capricorn once more that Jack said, "We shall raise St. Helena in the morning." "Shall we touch?" asked Stephen.
"Oh, no,"
said he. "Not even for a dozen bullocks? Are not you tired of junk?"
"Not I. And if you think there is any device, any ruse, that can take you ashore to collect bugs, pray think again."
And there, in the brilliant dawn, a black point broke the horizon, a black point with a cloud floating over it. Presently it showed clearer still, and Pullings pointed out the principal charms of the island. Holdfast Tom, Stone Top, and old Joan Point he had landed several times, and he did wish he could show the doctor the bird that haunted Diana's Peak, a cross between an owl and a poll parrot, with a curious bill. The frigate made her number to the tall signal station and asked, "Are there orders for surprise? Is there any mail?" "No orders for surprise," said the signal station, and paused for a quarter of an hour. "No mail," it said at last. "Repeat, no orders, no letters for surprise."
"Pray ask if the Lushington has passed by," said Stephen.
"Lushington called, left for Madeira 7th instant, all well aboard," said the station.
"Bear up," said Jack, and the frigate filled and stood on. "Muffet must have been lucky around the Cape. He will beat us to the Lizard and make his voyage in under 6 months. Did he risk the Mozambique Channel, the dog?"
Another dawn, of the exquisite purity that is frightening, the perfection must break and fade. This time it was the cry of a sail that brought all hands tumbling up faster than a bosun's pipe. She was standing southwards on the opposite tack, a man of war, in all probability. Half an hour later it was certain that she was a frigate, and that she was edging down. All hands stood by to clear for action, and the surprise made the private signal. She replied, together with her number, Lachesis. The tension died away to be replaced by a pleasant expectancy.
"We shall have some news at last," said Jack.
But as he spoke, another hoist broke out, charged with dispatches, and she hauled her wind. She might not heave to, not even for an admiral.
"Ask her if she has any mail,"
said Jack, and with his glass to his eye he read the answer before the signal midshipman. No mail for surprise.
"Well, be damned to you for a slab-sided tub," he said, as they drew rapidly apart. And at dinner he said, "You know what it is, Stephen? I wish we did not have that parson aboard. White is a very good fellow, nothing against him personally. I like him and should be happy to serve with him in any way, ashore. But at sea it is always reckoned bad luck to carry parsons. I am not in the least superstitious myself, as you know, but makes the hands uneasy. I would not have a chaplain in any ship of mine if I could help it. Besides, they are out of place in a man of war. It is their duty to tell us to turn the other cheek, and it don't answer. Not in action. I did not care for that ill-looking bird that crossed our bows, either."
"It was only a common booby, from Ascension, no doubt. This grog is the vilest brew, even with my cochineal and ginger in it. How I long for wine again, a good full-bodied red. Will I tell you something?
The more I know of the Navy, the more I am astonished that men of a liberal education should be so weak as to believe in bugaboos. In spite of your eagerness to be home, you declined sailing on a Friday, with your very pitiful excuse about the capstan. You will advance the plea that it is for the sake of the men, and to that I will reply, ha ha.
You may say what you please, but these things work. I could tell you tales that would raise the wig off your head.
All your sea omens are omens of disaster, and, of course, with man in his present unhappy state, huddled together in numbers far too great, and spending all his surplus time and treasure in beating out his brother's brains, any gloomy foreboding is likely to be fulfilled. But your corpse, your parson, your St. Elmo's fire is not the cause of the tragedy.
Jack shook his head, unconvinced, and after chewing on his wooden beef for some time, he said,
"As for your liberal education, I too can say, ha, ha. We sailors are hardly educated at all. The only way to make a sea officer is to send him to sea and to send him young. I have been afloat, more or less, since I was 12, and most of my friends never went much beyond the dame school. All we know is our profession, if indeed we know that. I should have tried the Mozambique Channel. No, we are not the sort of men that educated, intelligent, well-brought-up young women cross 1,000 miles of sea for. They like us well enough ashore, and are kind, and say, good old tarpaulin, when there is a victory. But they don't marry us, not unless they do it right away. Not unless we board them in our own smoke. Given time to reflect, as often as not, they marry parsons, or clever chaps at the bar.
Why, as to that, Jack, you undervalue Sophie. To love her is a liberal education in itself. Of course, you are an educated man in that sense. Besides, lawyers make notoriously bad husbands, from their habit of incessant prating, whereas your sailor has been schooled to mute obedience, said Stephen. And to divert the sad current of Jack's mind, he added, Giraldus Cabrensis asserts that the inhabitants of Ossory can change into wolves at their pleasure.
Back with his cryptograms, his conscience troubled him. He had been so steadily fixed upon his own pursuit, the hope of Madeira, the certainty of London, that he had paid little attention to Jack's anxiety, an anxiety that, like his own, had been growing as the vague, charming future became more sharply defined, more nearly the decisive present. He, too, was oppressed by a feeling that this great happiness of travelling, month after month, towards a splendid end, was soon to be broken, a sense not indeed of impending disaster, but rather of some uneasiness that he could not well define.
"That was the unluckiest stroke," he said, thinking of Jack's They Marry Parsons. Absit, oh, absit, oh, men!
For the deepest of his private superstitions, or ancestral pieties, was naming calls. He found the chaplain alone in the gunroom, setting up a problem on the chessboard.
"Pray, Mr. White," he said, "among the gentlemen of your cloth, have you ever met a Mr. Hinksey?" "Mr. Charles Hinksey?"
asked the chaplain, with a civil inclination of his head.
"Just so, Mr. Charles Hinksey." "Yes, I know Charles Hinksey well. We were at Magdalen together. We used to play fives and walk great distances. A delightful companion. No striving, no competition. And he was very well liked in the university. I was proud to know him. An excellent Grecian, too, and well connected. So well connected that he has 2 livings now, both of them in Kent, the one as fat as any in the county, and the other capable of improvement. And yet, you know, I do not believe any of us grudged or envied him, even the men without benefices. He is a good, sound preacher in the plain, unenthusiastic way. I dare say he will be a bishop soon, and so much the better for our church."
"Has the gentleman no faults?"
"I dare say he has," said Mr. White, "though upon my honour I cannot call any to mind. But even if he were another Chartres, I am sure people would still like him. He is one of your tall, handsome fellows, not at all witty or alarming, but always good company. How he has escaped marriage until now, I cannot tell. The number of caps set in his direction would furnish a warehouse. He is not at all averse to the state, I know, but I dare say he is hard to please."
Now the days flew by. Each was long in itself, but how quickly they formed a week, a fortnight. The baffling winds and calms of the outward voyage restored the average by sweeping the ship northwards across the line and up into the trades with hardly a pause, and presently the peak of Tenerife lay there on the starboard beam, a gleaming triangle under its private cloud nearly 100 miles away. The first consuming eagerness to reach Madeira was in no way diminished. Never for a moment did Jack cease driving the fragile ship with a spread of sail just this side of recklessness. But in both Aubrey and Maturin there was this increasing tension, dread of the event combining with the delight. The island loomed up in the north against a menacing sky. Before sunset it vanished in rain, a steady downpour from low cloud that washed runnels in the new paint on the frigate's sides. And in the morning there was Funchal Road, filled with shipping, and the white town brilliant behind it in the sparkling air. A frigate, the Amphion, the Badger sloop of war, several Portuguese, an American, innumerable tenders, fishermen, and small craft, and at the far end three Indiamen with their super yards on deck. The Lushington was not among them.
"Carry on, Mr. Hales," said Jack.
The guns saluted the castle, and the castle thundered back, the smoke rolling wide over the bay.
"Forward there! Let go!"
The anchor splashed into the sea, and the cable raced after it. But before the anchor could bite and swing the ship, there was the boom of guns again. Jack looked for a newcomer staring seawards before he realized that the Indiamen were saluting the surprise. The Lushington must have told them of the brush with Lenoir, and they were pleased.
"Give them seven, Mr. Hales," he said. "Lower down the barge."
Stephen was to go down the side first. He hesitated in the gangway, and Bondon, taking it for a physical uncertainty, whispered,
"Easy does it, sir. Give me your foot."
Jack followed him to the sound of bosun's pipes, and they rowed ashore, sitting side by side in their best uniforms, facing the bargemen, all shaved, all in white frocks, wearing broad white hats with long ribbons bearing the name Surprise. The only words Jack spoke were,
"Stretch out."
They went straight to their agent's correspondent, a Madeira Englishman.
"Welcome, sir," cried he. "As soon as I heard the Indiamen, I know it must be you. Mr. Muffet was in last week, and he told us about your noble action. Allow me to wish you joy, sir, and to shake you by the hand."
"Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Tell me, is there any young lady in the island for me, brought either by a king's ship or an Indiaman?"
"Young lady, sir? Oh, not that I know of. Certainly not in any king's ship. But the Indiamen only got in on Monday, cruelly mauled in the bay. She might still be in one of them. Here are their passenger lists."
Jack's eyes raced down the names, and instantly they fixed on Mrs. Villiers. Two lines farther down, Mr. Johnston.
"But this is the Lushington's," he cried.
"So it is," said the agent. "The others are Overleaf, Mornington, Bombay Castle, and Clive."
Twice Jack ran through them, and a third time slowly. There was no Miss Williams.
"Is there any mail?"
he asked in a flat voice.
"Oh, no, sir. Nobody would have looked for surprise at the island these many months yet. They would not have known you had sailed at home. I dare say your mail is aboard Bellerophon, with the last convoy down. But now I come to think of it, there was a message left in the office for a Dr. Maturin belonging to the Surprise, left by a lady from the Lushington. Here it is."
"My name is Maturin," said Stephen.
He recognised the hand, of course, and through the envelope he felt the ring. He said,
"Jack, I shall take a turn.
Good day to you, sir."
He walked steadily uphill wherever the path mounted, and in time he climbed through the small fields of sugarcane, through the orchards, through the terraced vineyards, and to the chestnut forest, up through the trees until they died away to scrub, and the scrub to a parched, meagre vegetation. And so, beyond all paths now, to the naked volcanic scree lying in falls beneath the central ridge of the island. There was a little sleety snow lying in the shadows up here, and he scooped handfuls of it to eat. He had wept and sweated all the water out of his body. His mouth and throat were as dry and cracked as the barren rock he sat on. He had walked himself into a dull apathy of mind, and although his cheeks were still wet, the wind blew cold upon them, he was beyond the immediate pain. Below there stretched a tormented landscape, sterile for a great way, then wooded, minute fields beyond, a few villages, and then the whole south sea line of the island with Funchal under his right hand, the shipping like white flecks, and beyond, the ocean rising to meet the sky. He looked at it all with a certain residual interest. Behind the great headland westwards lay the Camara de Lobos. Seals were said to breed there. The sun was no more than a hand's breadth above the horizon, and in the innumerable ravines the shadow reached from rim to rim, almost as dark as night.
"To get down, that will be a problem," he said aloud. "Any man can go up. Oh, almost indefinitely. But to go down, and down sure-footed, that is another thing entirely."
It was his duty to read the letter, of course, and in the last gleam of day he took it from his pocket, the tearing of the paper, a cruel sound.
He read it with a hard, cruel severity, yet he could not prevent a kind of desperate tenderness creeping over his face at the end. But it would not do. Weakness would never do, and with the same appearance of indifference he looked about for a hollow in the rocks where he could lie. Toward the setting of the moon his twitching, exhausted body relaxed and sank into the darkness at last. Some hours of dead sleep, a total absence. The circling sun, having lit Calcutta and then Bombay, came up on the other side of the world and blazed full on his upturned face, bringing him back into himself by force. He was still dazed with sleep when he sat up, and although he was conscious of an extreme pain, he could not immediately name it. The dislocated elements of memory fell back into place. He nodded, buried the ancient small iron ring that he had still clasped in his hand. The letter had blown away, and found a last patch of snow to rub his face. He was at the foot of the mountain by the afternoon, and as he was walking through Funchal, he met Jack in the cathedral square.
"I hope I have not kept you," he said.
"No, not at all," said Jack, taking him by the elbow. "We are watering. Come and drink a glass of wine."
They sat down, too heavy and stupid to be embarrassed. Stephen said,
"I must tell you this. Diana has gone to America with a Mr. Johnston of Virginia. They are to be married. She was under no engagement to me. It was only her kindness to me in Calcutta that let my mind run too far. My wits were astray. I am in no way aggrieved. I drink to her."
They finished their bottle, and another. But it had no effect of any kind, and they rowed back to the ship as silently as they had come. Her water completed and fresh provision brought aboard, the Surprise weighed and stood out to sea, going east about the island and heading into a dirty night. The gaiety forward contrasted strangely with the silence farther aft. As Bondon remarked, the ship seemed by the stern. The men knew that something was amiss with the skipper. They had not sailed so long with him without being able to interpret the look on his face. The captain of a man-of-war being an absolute monarch at sea, dispensing sunshine or rain. And they were concerned for the doctor, too, who looked but palely. Yet the general opinion was that they had both eaten some foreign mess ashore, that they would be better in a day or two with a thundering dose of rhubarb. And seeing that no rough words came from the quarter-deck, they sang and laughed as they won the anchor and made sail in tearing high spirits. For this was the last leg, and they had a fair wind for the Lizard. Wives and sweethearts, and paying off. Fiddler's Green in sight at last. The heaviness in the cabin was not a gloom, but rather a weary turning back to common life, to a commonplace life without much meaning in it, certainly no brilliant colour. Stephen checked the sickbay, and had a long session with Mallister over their books. In a week or so the ship would be paid off, and they would have to pass their accounts, justifying upon oath the expenditure of every dram and scruple of their drugs and comforts for the last 18 months, and Mallister had a morbidly tender conscience. Left to himself, Stephen looked at his private stock of laudanum, his bottled fortitude. At one time he had made great use of it, up to 4,000 drops a day, but now he did not even draw the cork. There was no longer any need for fortitude. He felt nothing at present, and there was no point in artificial ataraxy. He went to sleep sitting in his chair, slept through the exercising of the guns and far into the middle watch. Waking abruptly, he found light coming under his door from the great cabin, and there he found Jack still up, reading over his remarks for the Admiralty hydrographer. Innumerable soundings, drafts of the coastline, cross bearings, valuable, conscientious observations. He had become a scientific sailor.
"Jack," he said abruptly, "I have been thinking about Sophie. I thought about her on the mountain, and it occurs to me, the simplest thing, why did we not think of it before, that there is no certainty whatsoever about the courier. So many, many miles overland, through wild countries and desert. And in any case, the news of Canning's death must have travelled fast. It may have overtaken the courier. It must certainly have affected Canning's associates and their designs. There is every reason to believe that your message never reached her."
"It is kind of you to say that, Stephen," said Jack, looking at him affectionately, "and it is capital reasoning. But I know the news reached India House 6 weeks ago. Brenton told me. No. They used to call me Lucky Jack Aubrey, you remember, and so I was in my time. But I am not as lucky as all that. Lord Keith told me luck has its end, and mine is out. I set my sights too high, that's all. What do you say to a tune?"
with all my heart.
With the rain coming down outside, and the hanging lamp swinging wide as the sea got up, they soared away through their Corelli, through their Hummel, and Jack had his bow poised for Boccherini when he brought it screeching down on the strings and said, "That was a gun!" They sat motionless, their heads up, and a dripping midshipman knocked and burst in.
"Mr. Pulling's compliments, sir," he said, "and he believes there is a sail to leeward."
"Thank you, Mr. Lee, I shall be on deck directly."
He snatched up his cloak and said,
"God send it is a Frenchman. I'd rather meet a Frenchman now than—"
He vanished, and Stephen put the instruments away. On deck, the cold rain and the freshening southwester took his breath away after the air of the cabin, where the tropical heat, stored up under the line, still seeped from the hold. He came up behind Pullings, who was crouched at the rail with his glass.
"Well away, Tom," he said.
"Right on the quarter, sir, I reckon, in that patch of half-moonlight. I caught the flash, and just for a moment I thought I saw her putting about. Will you take a look, sir?"
Pullings could see her tolerably well, a ship under topsails, 3 miles off, standing from them on the starboard tack, a ship that had signalled to some unseen consort or convoy that she was going about. But he was attached to his captain. He was distressed by his unhappiness, and he wished to offer him this small triumph.
"By God, Pullings, you're right. A ship, on the starboard tack, close hauled. Where? Clew up topsails. Fetch her wake and see how near she will let us come. There is no hurry now," he muttered.
Then raising his voice,
"All hands, wear ship!"
The pipes and the roaring boatswain's mate roused the sleeping watch below, and some minutes later the Surprise was running down to cross the stranger's wake under courses alone, almost certainly invisible in this darkness. She had the wind 2 points free, and she gained steadily, creeping up on the stranger, guns run out, shielded battle lanterns faintly glowing along the main deck, bell silenced, orders given in an undertone. Jack and Pullings stood on the forecastle, staring through the rain. There was no need for a glass now, none at all, and a break in the cloud had shown them she was a frigate. If she was what he hoped she was, he would give her such a broadside in the first moment, and before the Surprise was over he would cross under her stern and rake her twice, perhaps 3 times, and then lie upon her quarter. Closer, closer. He heard her bell. 7 bells in the graveyard watch, and still no hail. Closer, and the sky was lightening in the east.
"Stand by the Clewlands," he called softly. "Bellow, mind your priming."
Still closer. His heart was pounding like a mallet.
"Let fall,"
he cried. The topsails flashed out. They were sheeted home in an instant, and the Surprise surged forward, racing up on the stranger's quarter. Shouts and bellowing ahead.
"What ship is that?"
he roared into the confusion.
"What ship is that?"
And over his shoulder,
"Back for topsail! Man clew garnets!"
The Surprise was within pistol shot, all her guns bearing, and he heard the returning hail,
"Euryalus! What ship is that?"
"Surprise! Heave to or I sink you,"
he replied. But the true fire had gone. Under his breath he said,
"God damn you all to hell for a set of lubbers."
Yet hope said it might still be a ruse, and as the ships came up into the wind he stood there still, twice his natural size and all aglow. But Euryalus she was, and there was Miller in his nightshirt on the quarterdeck, Miller far senior to him. He pitied the officer of the watch, the lookouts, that would be the devil to pay. Many a bloody back in the morning.
"Aubrey!"
hailed Miller.
"Where the devil do you come from?" "East Indies, sir, last from the island." "Why the devil did you not make the night signal like a Christian? If this is a joke, sir, a goddamned pleasantry, I'm not amused. Where the hell is my cloak? I'm getting wet. Mr. Lemon! Mr. Lemon! I will have a word with you presently, Mr. Lemon! Aubrey, instead of arsing about like a jack-in-the-box, just you run down to Athalian and tell him to mend his pace. Good day to you!"
He disappeared with a savage growl, and from the bow-port under Jack's feet a voice said,
"Euryalus!"
"What?"
said an answering voice from Euryalus's aftermost port.
"Bollocks to you!"
The Surprise bore up, ran leisurely down to the straggling Athalian in the growing light, a shamefully great way off, made the private signal and repeated Captain Miller's order. The Athalian acknowledged, and Jack was laying the course for Finisterre, when Church, the signal midshipman this watch, and an inexpert one too, said,
"She is signalling again, sir."
He stared through his telescope, struggled with the leaves of his book, and with the help of the yeoman he slowly read it off.
"Captain Surprise, I have 2 wool... no, women for you. Next hoist. 1 young. Please come to breakfast." Jack took the wheel, bawling out,
"Make sail! Bear a hand, bear a hand, bear a hand, look alive!"
The Surprise shot across the Athalian's bows and rounded to under her lee. He gazed across with a look of extreme apprehension, trying to believe and to disbelieve. And Heneage Dundas called out from the quarterdeck,
"Good morning, Jack! I have Miss Williams here! Will you come across?"
The boat splashed down, half filling in the choppy sea. It pulled across. Jack leapt for the side, raced up, touched his hat to the quarterdeck, crushed Dundas in his arms, and was led to the cabin, unshaved, unwashed, wet, ablaze with joy. Sophie curtsied. Jack bowed. They both blushed extremely, and Dundas left them, saying he would see to breakfast. Endearments, a hearty kiss, endless explanations, perpetually interrupted and re-begun. Dear Captain Dundas, so infinitely considerate, had exchanged into this ship, had been away on a cruise, and they had been obliged to chase a privateer almost to the Bahamas, and had very nearly caught him. Several shots had been fired.
"I tell you what it is, Sophie," cried Jack. "I have a parson aboard. I've been cursing him up hill and down dale for a Jonah. But now how glad I am! He shall marry us this morning."
"No, my dear," said Sophia, "properly, and at home, and with Mamma's consent, yes, whenever you like. She will never refuse now, but I did promise it. The minute we get home, you shall marry me in Champflower Church, if you really wish it. But if you don't, I will sail round and round the world with you, my dear. How is Stephen?"
"Stephen? Lord, sweetheart, what a selfish brute I am. A most shocking, damned thing has happened. He thought he was to marry her. He longed to marry her. It was quite understood, I believe. She was coming home in an Indiaman, and at Madeira she left her and bolted with an American. A very rich American, they say. It was the best thing that could possibly have happened for him, but I would give my right hand to have her back. He looks so low. Sophie, it would break your heart to see him. But you will be kind, I know."
Her eyes filled with tears, but before she could reply, her maid came in, bobbed severely to Jack, and said breakfast was ready. The maid disapproved of the whole proceeding, and from the frightened, deprecating look of the steward behind her, it was clear that she disapproved of sailors, too. Breakfast, with Dundas giving Jack a circumstantial account of his exchange, and of the privateer, and insisting on a rehearsal of the action with Lenoir, was a long, rambling meal, with dishes pushed aside and pieces of toast representing ships, which Jack manoeuvred with his left hand, holding Sophia's under the table with his right, and showing the disposition of his line at different stages of the battle, while she listened with eager intelligence and a firm grasp of the weather gauge. A rambling, exquisite meal that was brought to a close by the fury of Captain Miller's repeated guns. They came on deck. Jack called for a bosun's chair to be rigged, and while it was preparing, Stephen and Sophie waved to one another without a pause, smiling and crying out,
"How are you, Stephen? How are you, my dear?"
Jack said,
"Heneage, I am so very much obliged to you, so deeply obliged. Now I have but to run Sophie and my treasure home, and the future is pure paradise."
This concludes the reading of HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien. Copyright 1973 by Patrick O'Brien. This book was read by Simon Vance. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Georges Borchardt, Inc., and was produced in 2004 by Blackstone Audiobooks, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto.